Hello, Annie Trenders. Welcome to the Girl Taku, hosted by the ladies of Anime Trending. If you're looking for a nice tea and deep dive analysis about otaku themes, you've come to the right place. We love our conversation and discussion, and we're back with another fun topic on the table. My name is Gracie, and I'm joined by...
Hello, I am Isabel, and...
This is Agnes.
So, without further ado, the Girl Taku today will be a trope dissection. We haven't done one in a while, I feel like, but today's trope dissection is villain protagonist. So, it's when the protagonist of the anime that we are watching is actually the villain of the story, because protagonist doesn't mean a good person. It just means the main character, the point of view, the character that you follow throughout the story. And the antagonist is just who opposes them. There's no right or wrong associated with those terms. So today we are essentially looking at protagonists who are the bad guys of the story. And with that being said, Agnes is kicking us off this week. And like all of our trope dissections, we always do one bad example of one we don't think they've managed to pull off, one good example that we think they did manage to pull off, and, you know, sort of compare and contrast the two, explain what makes them work or what makes them doesn't work. And as always, Agnes, I also want to start off by asking, how do you feel about this trope in particular?
This trope in particular, I was doing some research on it, and I was kind of fascinated by how many good villain protagonists there are in anime. Mm-hmm. Like, I had to be straight up, like, the majority of the lists that I've seen online and also doing my own personal research, I've done, oh yeah, I do like this character. Oh yeah, I think they were executed very well in this series. And it's actually very hard for me to find a bad villain protagonist.
Okay.
If anything, it's more of like, I think what anime does really well is doing the anti-hero or the villain protagonist role, because you see the world through their eyes. Mm-hmm. But what they do poorly is making the actual antagonist for the series, regardless of who the protagonist is. So I wanted to give first start with my quote unquote bad villain protagonist, but she's not really a bad villain protagonist because she is the antagonist of the series, but it seems like her point of view kind of shifts over to her by second season. But even I don't think she's a real villain protagonist anyway. But I have to talk about her anyway because that's the only one I have. And it'll be very short because I've talked about her before on this channel for sure.
Okay, so who is it?
It's Prospera from G-Witch, from Gundam Witch from Mercury.
Oh, you think she's a protagonist? I totally thought she was an antagonist.
She is technically an antagonist at the first season, but it's because the role of an actual protagonist by season two does not become solidified. Miordine and Suleta really take a huge, like, they really sit back in season two. They really don't do a lot of very active things. And it's actually Prospera who drives the story and drives the engagement. Okay. That's the reason why, that's why I say, like, she's not really a protagonist in her own right because she doesn't start as a protagonist, but she actively makes deals with Miorine and makes deals with Miorine saying, if you want to save Soleta's future, your cute little wife, you're going to have to make a deal with me and you're going to have to learn about my great evil scheme. And Miorine is like, fine, I will cooperate with you. And then you learn about, like, Prospera's whole, like, shtick about why she does the things that she does. And season two, as we know, was not executed well anyway, so I think that's why she's kind of like a really bad villain antagonist. And then I also mentioned a villain protagonist, and then I also mentioned earlier how Prospera's villain protagonist ideals and reason why she does the thing that she does is very typical of how anime likes to portray mothers and not give women agency as villains. And in this particular viewpoint, she's only doing it because she wants to take revenge, and it's always done out of love rather than a loftier scheme or something that's a little bit more petty. I feel that a lot of other Japanese antagonists or Japanese villain protagonists, like, let's say, for example, like Light Yagami from Death Note, have their very own personal motives that feels a lot more selfish. But for Prospera, it's always rooted in love. It's always rooted in the fact that her daughter is dead. So that's why I wanted to kind of point her out. But again, as I said, it's not really exemplary of a villain protagonist because she isn't really one in the first place. And second of all, it's really hard to find a bad villain protagonist in my mind.
Okay, so I have to ask, since I obviously didn't watch Gundam Witch from Mercury, I always thought, based on how the first part ended because it blew up on Twitter that she was the final bad that the protagonist, aka Soleta and Miorin, were supposed to fight. But you're telling me that doesn't happen at all.
No, it really doesn't happen at all, because while Prospera manipulates Soleta into doing these things, Miorine also kind of has to concede with Prospera's like demands and cooperate with her if she wants to protect Soleta.
That's interesting.
And the way that they do it is like really weird, convoluted, like business deals. I talked about it with some other friends who are like really big Gundam fans, and even they kind of agree, like, it's not great. The execution and the writing of the story into season two is not good. And it's not because they're homophobic about Soleta or Miorine, but rather that it's not done well at all, especially on the standard for a Gundam show, right? Like, if you look at other Gundam shows that came out even before, like, for example, Iron Blood Orphans, there's, like, a huge reception for Iron Blood Orphans, right? Mm-hmm. But for something like Gundam, which everyone was kind of like, what was the ending? What's going on? Okay, I guess Prospera is now the quote-unquote protagonist because she leads the changes and the plot development of this story. You could say like Guel is a protagonist in his own right too, because he did win best boy of the year and best male side character of the year, but at the same time, even he wasn't driving the story forward too. He's only a small figment of the entire story as a whole. So
okay, that's really interesting, because I definitely knew with the way people Or I definitely thought with the way people flipped out at the end of the...
They only flipped out at the end because really it's only a shock value. It's only the shock value. Well, the shock value that... Here's the thing. Gundam has always had a bloody plot.
Right.
People die in Gundam. That's very standard in Iron Blood Orphans, in like Gundam Unicorn, Gundam Seed, any Gundam film or series that you watch, a lot of people die, and that's expected. But Gundam G Witch Mercury starts off in a very cozy setting of school. No one's dead yet. And it's not until the very final episode of season one where Soleta actually kills people and other people are being killed by others. Like, let's say Guel actually kills his father without knowing it. He was set up actually to kill his father without knowing it. That's when everyone was like, oh my gosh, shock factor. Everything from here is going to go downhill. It's going to be like a true Gundam series where everybody dies. And then season two comes in and everyone's like, well, not really. It's kind of boring, if anything else. So that's why I kind of wanted to like bring in G-Witch, because it's kind of like a little bit controversial on both the Gundam side of how things usually operate from Gundam side, and then also like how problematic a lot of the character setup is, especially for somebody like Prospera.
Like, despite not watching it, kind of disappointed that she it's very wasn't disappointing. An antagonist. Like, I'm
it's,
like,
it's very disappointing. I mean, like, even at the very end, Prospera lives.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she lives. It's really weird. So it's like, I don't want to bore you with the details of like the intricacies of like the Gundam and what happened and yada yada yada, because even that to me, I was like, I don't understand this, and I have to go read the wiki for it. But the end deal is like they kind of forgive Prospera for what she does, because Prospera was also doing all of this while being handicapped. She was nearing the end of her life. But instead of like outright killing her, they're all like, well, let's just live like a happy little family. So Miorine goes and does business deals or whatever. Soleta stays on the planet that they call their home and, you know, like basically recuperates and things like that. And then she stays with her mom, who is now paralyzed from like head to toe, and is apparently more docile now and not as confining as she was in season one and two. So it's very bizarre in general. That's why she's like a bad example of like a villain protagonist, because she wasn't supposed to be one. But she ended up being one, and it was executed horribly.
Okay.
Hopefully that clears things up, and it incentivizes you to not watch Gundam Witch for Mercury.
I mean, it's disappointing to hear that, because, yeah, once again, my biggest shock was, like, what? She wasn't in it?
Yeah, she like I said, I can't even pinpoint an actual protagonist in all of season two, because Soleta and Miorine really took a backseat. And I was disappointed, because I'm like, where's my girl boss Miorine and her like cute little wife Soleta? Like, that's really disappointing.
Yeah. Well, okay, so you generally seem to like the villain protagonist you've seen in the anime. So which is the one you've picked to showcase as like a really good one?
I have two of them that I have to spotlight, because I think there's a really cool dissonance between like the male and female portrayal of a villain protagonist.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Rather than like a protagonist male versus female. So the first one that I want to talk about is not really female. It's Tanya from Saga of Tanya the Evil.
Oh, you know, a little muddled in regards to it, yes.
Yeah, muddled in what sense?
No, I meant like the gender on whether it's a guy
or
a girl.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's like, muddled. So.
Is Tanya male or female? Because as some of the viewers may not know, the original identity of Tanya was a Japanese middle-aged Japanese salaryman who got isekai'd after getting kicked into a train track and reincarnates into a very young child's body, a female child's, a girl's body, and deciding that he was in this child's body in the middle of like a fictitious like World War One, World War Two, where magic is involved, he's like, well, I don't want to be involved in war, but I will do everything in my power to get the comfy seat at the back of the military where I don't have to do jack. But God's just kind of like, well, technically not God, Identity X, right? They call it Identity X. Identity X is like, well, no, I must have you regard the fact that you have magical powers that are bestowed by me. And then Tanya is like, no, I am not obligated to listen to any of your demands and any of your orders, and I do not need to praise to you to be able to use my magical powers. And Identity X was like, bet. So it's this whole like petty, like very
so petty.
It's so petty, and it's so amusing to watch because yes, Tanya does horrific acts. Tanya belongs to an empire that is essentially the fictitious Nazis, and he goes ham on killing everybody that he's supposed to kill, coming up with really horrible racial tactics to use against others, and also just obliterating people in his path just so that he can get the comfy spot in the military. But also it's because he has beef with Identity X. So I thought Tanya's was really funny because it takes like that edginess out of the villain protagonist identity, like being like, oh, I'm the anti-hero. Oh, I need to save the world, but I'm doing it in my own twisted way. And just making it really petty with Tanya just being like, I don't want to listen to any of your demands and I want to carve out my own identity. And Identity X says like, well, you can try. So it's just really fun to watch overall, even though there are actually horrific scenes being put on screen.
I mean, I definitely think Tanya is a really fun character, very much. I think she absolutely, or she, they, he, them.
And it doesn't matter at this point what we call them. I think in general the anime community does not care what gender they are because they're like, yeah, it's nebulous.
Yeah, it's just like, but they are really fun and really, really petty, and the pettiness is part of the fun.
They're so petty. I read some of the light novels for Saga of Tanya the Evil and I was like, oh, it's worse than the light novel.
Something about pettiness is really fun, and I don't know why. Like, why do we like
it's
pettiness?
It's just entertaining. I think we're so tired of watching heavy drama where, like, people's, like, emotionally invested for, like, certain reasons. And it's a way for you to root for them, for sure. But sometimes we just need to watch trash. And sometimes we need to root for also trash characters so we can feel better about ourselves.
Mm. How do you feel about Tanya, Isabel?
I haven't seen the show, but based on what I've seen, they seem really entertaining, and so I definitely agree with that.
They're super entertaining,
and it seems like
I think you would agree with.
They might be pretty unpredictable as well. Is that correct? Or
in the enemy's eyes, yes, Tanya seems very unpredictable, but Tanya actually uses a lot of military knowledge that they know from the future, basically. Not so much of like, oh, I know that this plan will turn out this way because of history books, but because they've read like general military tactics and understand how bureaucracy works in like a modern day sense for like business salesmen and companies, that they use it to exploit against armies and officials.
Oh, I see. Okay. That's the reason why.
Because if it's like saying, like, if you were to be transported from this current time period where, you know, like tanks exist or like certain strategies of how like people like corner their enemies or how they strip them of their resources and things like that, if you apply it to like an even prior timeline, you would basically win very quickly because they don't have that prior knowledge of how they could execute that. So Tanya has that advantage, but even then Tanya has a lot of setbacks as an isekai protagonist because for one, they don't want to use their OP granted power by Identity X simply because they don't want to. So in a way, they're forced to kind of use their wits and whatever military their power that they have in order to win things. And so it's really fun to also watch them struggle too.
Yeah, I mean, just think about how, like, think about it. You're granted this great power and you refuse to use it because you hate the person who granted to petty right there. That's pettiness on a pedestal.
Or it's like, if you like, take it in the concept of, like, Konosuba, right?
Oh, like, for example, yeah.
Like, the main character of Konosuba is just like, I hate Aqua. And Aqua's like, no, I want you to rely on me. And MC is like, no, you're fucking useless. And that's kind of like the same way with Tanya and Identity X, where like Tanya refuses to use their power, but Identity X wants Tanya to use his power so that he can be like worshipped, essentially. Yeah. So hopefully that puts things a little bit more into context for you, Isabel.
Oh yeah, it definitely does.
Okay, cool.
Okay, so you said you have two.
Yes. The other one I thought was really interesting when I was going through, and I totally forgot about her. And I think she kind of deviates from the role of Prospera, in which Prospera is just like, I am a female villain, and therefore all of my my reasoning for living and for the things that I do has to be rooted in love. Coco from Jormungon, is actually very different in that regard. She is an arms dealer, which already makes her a very bad person, right? Objectively. And her family runs a massive arms dealing network and corporation that spreads globally from like the United States to Europe and then some parts of Asia as well. And while Coco is a villain in her own right because she deals arms, there is also an underlying plot of Coco wanting to enact what she calls the plan, or is actually the title of this series, called Jormungon. And the title of this plan was basically her way of trying to eradicate warfare throughout the entire world by imposing her law or her right.
Mm-hmm.
And her idea of defeating, like, ending warfare was to collaborate with a Japanese scientist who she's best friends with and create like quantum computers and satellites that would go up in the air and basically block all air traffic and control.
You know, such a classic, like, it's weird because we are already examining a trope, but like a trope within a trope, such a classic villain protagonist trope of where it's like they have this grand vision.
Yes,
and it's like exactly. The ends justify the means for
yes,
them.
Yes, and and even Coco and her colleague at the end of season two, even they admit, like, at the time that we decide to basically do world domination for the sake of world peace, there will be people who will die in the atmosphere when this technology goes live,
mm-hmm.
right? Because all these people will be, like, shot out of the air, or they'll be, like, decimated to pieces by whatever. And there are people in the series who do call out Coco for the things that she does, because they're just like, that's not right, that's not morally just, or that doesn't really solve the problem at all. But in her mind, she thinks that's the correct solution to dealing with warfare. And I wanted to bring up Coco and why I think she's a really fascinating villain protagonist is because that role of her motives is typically not put on a female villain. It's
true.
Very much of a veiled villain. So if you think
I agree.
Like, I'll give an example for some of the viewers, because I know you two know what I'm talking about. The father of Shinji in Evangelion is a great example of that. And there are tons of other male villains who have that same motivation, but that motivation is almost never seen in female protagonists, even, or even female antagonists, like, because Prospera does everything out of love rather than the ends justify the means. So that's why I really wanted to highlight Coco. And then also Coco is a very interesting and enigmatic character because she's very charismatic. She's also very into arms deals, so she understands like how to do the negotiation and when to pressure and when not to pressure and when to form alliances and stuff like that. And I just think she really stands out. She's kind of like what you would consider a younger and a more charismatic version of Balalaika from Black Lagoon.
Okay.
I also thought about putting Revy on this list too from Black Lagoon. But in terms of like prowess and wit and charisma, I think Coco outranks Revy, because Revy, at the end of the day, she's a mercenary. She's kind of like at the lower part of the totem pole and struggles with a lot of like nihilism, PTSD, and isn't really as much of a villain protagonist as Coco really is. So that's why I wanted to highlight Coco from Jormungand than like Revy from Black Lagoon.
Yeah, no, I love the point of you saying like, usually it's not the female character who takes this role in the first place. And I'm like, you're absolutely correct. Like you could,
right?
You probably would need to scour the internet to find.
And it's really hard to find it. And even then, like in her line of work in Jormungand, there are lots of male characters who try to upset her.
Mm.
You know, she has a twin brother named Casper who also works within the arms deals business with her. But he doesn't agree with her plan to Jormungand. They have their father who runs the actual business himself, but even he doesn't know her plans about Jormungand. And there are obviously other enemy arms dealers, and then they also involve like the CIA and things like that too. So there's a lot of men who are against Coco. And sometimes you're kind of like, well, girl boss, gatekeep and gaslight, right? Something like that. So that's why I'm just like, well, I support Coco's wrongs, I guess.
I mean, she sounds fascinating. I actually didn't watch this anime, which I know is shocking because I looked her up and she is exactly the type of character I would have latched on to.
Oh, yeah. I don't think you would like this one as much because it is very heavy on military politics. Mm-mm. And also about military weaponry and technology. Because Coco, because she is an arms dealer, she has like this encyclopedic knowledge of arms dealing. So helicopters, rocket launchers, guns, and things like that. And that, I think, for you is not as appealing to the actual drama of war politics. So I don't think you'll be as fascinated with Jormungand as compared to something like 86, where you see more of the dramatization of the characters and a little less nitty-gritty of war type of things.
Interesting.
Because I know you like war stories too, but you like to focus more on the people than the actual technology.
Yes, that is true.
Yeah. Jormungand can be a little bit heady on the technology, and then also when the CIA gets involved in season 2, it becomes a lot more convoluted too.
Okay. Well, yeah. What about you, Isabel? Have you seen this one? I haven't, like I said already.
No, yeah, I haven't seen either, but you talking about Coco seems like a very interesting character. Is she like the main protagonist of the series?
She is,
or
the they call her the Deuterogatus.
Oh.
Because she ends up hiring a young child soldier named Jonah. I think, Gracie, you would have latched onto Jonah even more because he's like the silent, traumatized child who also has silver hair.
Mm.
Yeah. But Jonah is really interesting because Jonah is he was raised as a child soldier, but he dislikes weapons. And it just so turns out that in his life, as a child soldier, he ends up he ends up killing his original employer because his original employer did something that's so heinous that Jonah didn't agree with it and rebelled. And then he was eventually taken in by the corporation that Coco works for. He was actually found by Coco's brother, Casper, and then was enlisted into becoming her forces. And then she and Jonah bonds very closely. There are some very questionable things that happen in Jormungand too, with the fact that Coco is very openly affectionate with Jonah, to the point where you're kind of like, is she grooming him? Is she not?
Hmm.
But Jonah, it turns out that Jonah is also very much kind of like her steady rock because he also dislikes the idea of warfare and kind of tries to keep her like grounded within reality before she kind of gets like caught up in her lofty ideals of ending war.
Oh, that's kind of interesting. So there's like this balance because he doesn't like warfare, but she's like, that's her whole job and whole thing.
Yeah,
and so
the two of them are kind of like, weirdly enough, like kindred spirits because they're stuck in this role. They didn't choose the family or the life that they ended up with, but they kind of have to make do with their situation. Versus for the majority of Coco's like mercenary team that she employs with, they're all veterans who have been like in various defense nation forces or have worked as mercenaries for other companies or other people before, but they don't really, because it's their profession and not something that they grew up with, they kind of don't see the whole point of her project. And so you'll see a lot of variety of characters who are kind of like, well, warfare is warfare, but it's just a job, versus Coco's like, no, this is an ideal that we can achieve. And that it's not impossible, we just have to work towards it. So I thought it was a really interesting contrast between the two of them. But like I said, Jormungand is very heavy on the on the technical details about warfare, about guns, tanks, rockets, missiles. You'll hear a lot of names being thrown out. For military geek and above, this is really cool stuff. But for the average everyday user, it can be a watcher, it can be very heavy or very boring, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
All righty. Well, thank you for sharing those villain protagonists with us. And the baton goes to me in this case. And I just honestly want to echo what Agnes said. I think a lot of the villain protagonists that anime does do, they do it quite well. Like, I'm not gonna lie. Yep. I was trying to think of original anime because original anime tends to jump the shark, you know, like that sort of concept. But then the easiest one that came to my head was Angelo from 91 Days, and I was like, no, I liked him as the villain protagonist, you know, I liked the way he was written. So I was kind of going through each of them, and I finally settled on Ayano Koji from Classroom of the Elite, which is ironic because I liked him in the first season, but I think the second season completely ruined his character as the villain protagonist. And this largely has to do with how the adaptation happens, because once again, the first season did a much better job of adapting the source material, where his reveal of what he actually is and what he's actually like, which is extremely selfish and manipulative, was a genuinely well done twist, because they did not voice his internal monologues. They don't read out his thought process. They don't try to explain why he does these certain things. So what you're seeing is only what he's hearing and what he's doing. And that makes it a lot easier for the anime to lead you astray into thinking he's an ordinary guy who thinks he's selfish, but everything he's doing shows that he's not, which is also an archetype that we see a lot in anime, only for the twist to be revealed at the very end where it finally voices his internal monologue. The second season, I think, was just an utter disaster because it also takes a turn to comical villainy. In the first season, the way that he manipulates things is actually pretty, like for high schoolers especially, because don't forget, they're all high school students. It's actually doable. As in, like, I absolutely believe people would fall for his manipulations. They were genuinely pretty, like, subtle in regards to how he did it. I don't know how similar it is to the light novel series, if the directors changed things to make it more subtle, but regardless, the first season genuinely made his manipulations more subtle. The second season was just laughable in regards to his manipulations. Like, and it doesn't help that he thinks that now the anime is, like, reading all his thoughts out loud. And it's the stupid, like, 4D, 5D chess of, like, oh, you know, like, have you guys seen The Princess Bride?
Yes.
No.
Oh.
Have you not seen The Princess Bride?
Okay, we need to watch it.
Travesty!
This does not spoil anything, I promise. But there's, like, this one scene where there's, like, a chess match happening. Or not chess match, where there's, like, a poison cup thing happening. And the bad guy just goes, like, now, a normal man would think you put poison in my cup. But a smarter man knows that you would have put poison in your own cup. But then that has to assume that you are the smarter man. Because if you're not the smarter, like, you know what I mean? It's just, like, going in circles of trying to, like, rationalize and predict a person's action in regards to where they put the poison. And that's exactly what Ayano Koji's internal monologues read like whenever he starts talking about, and then this character, and then this character, and then this character, but then this might happen sort of thing. I'm just like, oh god, like, now you're just sad. Like, I'm sorry. It's very, very laughable. So basically, that's how I feel about the whole Ayano Koji thing. Once again, it kind of ruined the first season a lot for me, seeing all this happen after the fact. So there's just not much to talk about. But I think this is an example of badly written villain protagonists, because they don't bother to make him a believable villain anymore. He's just... And I'm going to get people upset, but he's just a clown. That's what it feels like to me. So,
damn.
Yeah. I know you two haven't seen it, because the last time I spoke about Classroom of the Elite, neither of you two knew about it. But I think you two have seen the memes of like edgy teenage boys being like, oh, he's like me, you know, like that sort of thing. Yes. Yeah. I think the funny thing is like the first season, you probably wouldn't really believe the fact that you're like him because actually it's very subtle. But then by the second season where you're like, oh, he is like me for real, that's when you're like, okay, you've lost the plot. So yeah, that is my first pick of a bad villain protagonist. Absolutely comical at this point. So the example I have for a good villain protagonist is actually one of my favorites, and it is Reinhard from Legend of the Galactic Heroes.
Oh, okay, okay, okay.
Yeah.
I'm actually surprised you didn't go with some other ones like Askeladd or Avilo from 91 Days, but go on.
I literally was thinking about those two. you literally guessed the ones on my short list of trying to pick who to go with, but I ultimately went with...
like I said, I was going through these and I was just like, well, I gotta pick something that's different from Gracie because it seems like we both like the villain protagonist roles, so...
Right? I really like Reinhard for Legend of the Galactic Heroes because it is unequivocally that his antagonist is the most morally upright good person in the entire series. Yang Wenli is the best guy in there. He is extremely moral, very ethical, huge believer in freedom of rights and democracy, and very much fights for it, does not back down from that concept at all. And he is against the protagonist, who is Reinhard, because Reinhard is essentially trying to usurp the royal family in the Galactic Empire that he lives in. And then afterwards, later, by the point of like, and I'm including the remake in this, he starts expanding his territory, encroaching onto Democratic Alliance planets and trying to encroach onto territories that also belong to someone else that already have their own cultures and such. And it's fascinating because Legend of Galactic Heroes is very philosophical, which is the author's like sort of bread and butter. He's known for writing very philosophical novels wrapped in a lot of war of different time periods, of different fantasy or sci-fi. But really, it's so, like, the politics of it is so interesting and such a delicate balancing act. And Yang Wenli, like, voices it perfectly, too, because Yang Wenli is especially wary of Reinhard, and for good reason, because Reinhard essentially represents, like, it's totalitarianism, because Reinhard is trying to become emperor, and on top of that, trying to expand the empire, which means he will get to rule so many planets and have total say in regards to what he wants to do and how he wants to go about it. And the other thing is, and Yao Wenli is thinking to himself, like, what makes Reinhard so difficult as an opponent is that a lot of Reinhard's politics in regards to what he wants to forcibly implement are good things, because under the current royal family, they have no freedom of press, they have no freedom of speech, and the class divide is very, very difficult. And Reinhard, coming from a lower class, well, his family used to be upper class, but then became lower class, so having experienced that extreme shift in classes, like, his plan once he gained power was to forcibly implement these changes: freedom of press, freedom of speech, and making class mobility a lot easier, actually forcibly taking money from the upper class families to redistribute to the poor. And only someone with absolute power could have the ability to do that. And Yao Wenli is like, you know, what's so difficult about this is that he is the Democratic Alliance's enemy. So it's easy for people to think whatever he does is the opposite of who we are. But a lot of the stuff that he is forcibly implementing isn't bad. And in fact, you could even argue is good. So it's also forcing us into a difficult position of being against him, and by proxy, being against really liberal things that he's promoting. And that's exactly what happens to the democratic government. When Reinhard steps into place and he starts forcing these liberal changes, the Democratic Alliance immediately was like, oh my God, we don't want him. We want him to be like that. So we got to go opposite. We got to, you know, like, no, you can't criticize the Democratic government. Like, that's not allowed anymore. And no, like you steal it. Like, you can't try to redistribute wealth because that's stealing and that's unallowed, you know, that sort of thing. And it makes, and it ironically pushes the Democratic Alliance to also be more and more similar to a authoritarian government in the process as well. So, and it's just fascinating seeing that play out, because Reinhardt at the end of the day he wants power, and he sought after power for a very initially selfish reason. His sister, who was only like 14 years old, essentially, or 16 years old, got sold to an emperor who was already in his 50s because she was gorgeous and the emperor wanted her as his mistress. Like, that's all it was. And his dad just willingly handed her over to the emperor because that was the emperor and he gets to decide these things. And it pissed off a young Reinhardt so much that a young Reinhardt was like, okay, so it's just the royal family came into power by taking it, right? So what's stopping me from taking this power? What, like, why can't I do it? And that's what starts this whole thing. It comes from a really selfish place. And once again, he is, like, implementing good stuff, but he's doing it under total control. No one gets a say against him in this regard. And so I think, like, this duality of, like, when you have total power but you're doing good things, it's so sticky and troubling. And that's exactly what troubles Yang Wenli so much as, you know, Reinhardt's antagonist. And I think that's also what propels Legend of the Galactic Heroes into such a classic story as it is today, and how dangerous, like, a total authority can feel, you know, because it is kind of enticing to hear a guy have complete control to essentially make all these changes however you want it to be. Like, that is really enticing. So, and on top of all that, of course, Reinhardt is very charismatic and also very intelligent and everything else. So, yeah, that's my pick for a good villain, protagonist in a series that I've seen. I don't think Isabel's seen Legend of the Galactic Heroes, but I know that Agnes took a peek at some of the episodes and stuff, so I'm guessing she knows a little more about what I'm talking about here.
Just very little. Very little. Because obviously I didn't watch the season that came after, and I think the sequel movie that came after. So I have very little information about Galactic Heroes otherwise.
Yeah, I've been meaning to go back to it. I did check out a few episodes, and I really like the premise, and I can see exactly where it comes from, that Reinhardt, actually I thought both Yang Wenli and Reinhardt were like protagonists in the sense, just on the opposite sides, but yeah, I just really, it's hard for me to label him as a villain, and that's when you know it's kind of like a great show, because you see both sides. And so, like, I would say both of them, they're like either they're the protagonist or the antagonist, but you can't really label them that way, or whether they're the, you know, villain or hero, because there's like a push and pull. There's like positives and negatives of what he's doing. But yes, I wish I watched more as well. I know it's a longer series, but have you watched the older one as well, or just the new one?
I watched the older one, and then I watched the newer ones. I actually like both. I mean, the story's a little too solid to, like, you know, mess it up, essentially. I mean, you really can, but it really is a little too solid to try to mess it up. I think...
knocking on wood to make sure they don't mess anything up for it.
Yeah, I know. It's like, and you're right, because coming to the conclusion that Reinhardt is a villain protagonist was difficult, but if you do write it out as bullet points, you see a guy who forcefully usurped a royal family, which is, you know, revolutions happen, but then gives himself complete control, lets himself do whatever he wants, and then expands the empire's territory, colonizing other worlds. You know, it's like, yeah, only a villain would do something like that. You can't try to say that is a good person. Meanwhile, Yang Wenli is completely on the opposite end of the spectrum in that regard. But it's fascinating because you're almost in denial of saying that makes him a villain, because you do see the good stuff that he brings in with his absolute power. And then you're like, but it's his absolute power. You know, like, should a man be able to do something like that? So, I love Legend of the Galactic Heroes as a whole. It covers a lot. And I think it's interesting because the author, when he was writing it, it's very reflective of the politics of Japan at that time. Around that time, Japan was becoming more right. I think that was like actually the shifting era where
it was the shift before they are what they are now, which is more right wing or conservative.
Yes, exactly. And he wrote it during that time. And a lot of his a lot of his stories take a lot of historical elements, which he's basically a historian. He knows a lot about history. But on top of that, it was reflecting the political times of Japan because as we know today with the right in Japan, they do. You know, they still at this point they limit a lot of people's rights. I mean, gay people are still fighting for their rights, even though the courts are finally starting to judge on their side. And it's like it took 2010 something for workplace harassment to even be outlawed, like that sort of thing. But around that time, Japan was really. Japanese people were really attracted to the allure of that. Well, if we have complete control over the government, we can implement all these changes that you want. And when he's writing, and he does talk about an interview, you know, when he's writing these novels, this novel, Legend of Galactic Heroes series, he was just like, isn't that what we want at the end? Is just to get what we want regardless of what gets sacrificed at the end for it. And it's such a chilling question, I feel like, when he puts it like that. So huge fan of the whole work and of the series as a whole. Alrighty, I've talked enough. So Isabel, I want you to go ahead and take this mic away from me. So okay. First of all, do you like this trope? And then second of all, what's your bad and good example?
Yeah, for this trope, it really depends. I think for me, it was a little bit harder to find shows that I was really invested in where the protagonist was a villain for the most part. Mm. But yes, otherwise, I do think, like you said, they're written really well. And there are definitely a lot of examples where they are the villain, but you see, like, they actually might be a good person, or, you know, they turn into maybe the protagonist or turn into one of the heroes. And so it's like character development in a sense. But the first one that I wanted to talk about that I thought had bad villains, I liked the show, but I did not think that they were villains, and I think they were written kind of poorly, is actually Terror in Resonance.
Ah, mm-hmm. I see what you mean. Yes.
Yeah.
Terrorists. Yeah.
And surprisingly enough, Terror in Resonance did win our, I believe in 2015, like the best anime of the year. And I think it totally did deserve that based on how the anime went. There was so much hype, at least back then, for it when it was airing, and I liked it a lot. But I do think the characters, I think they were 9 and 12 because they had numbers as their names. Yeah, they were not terrorists. They were trying to act as terrorists. And I thought, I was hoping, like, in the first few episodes that when they were, like, sending up bombs across Japan and trying to get people's attention on them, I was hoping there would be consequences of people actually dying, but no one really died. And so it felt like they were trying to play a cat and mouse type of game, like chasing each other, like between them setting up the bombs and then making up these riddles. And I think the riddles were probably the best part of the series as well. It kind of made the viewers entertained or interested, like, oh, can I figure this riddle out before the cops can figure it out? And see what they were plotting or the next episode, right? But other than that, like, if that wasn't there, I feel like the show might have been even more boring in a sense. But yes, the fact that they were just trying to set those things up, kind of leading the police in a different way, but then, like, still also, like, setting up the bombs, but then people are still, like, evacuating, or they're, like, you know, they bomb in places where there's no one at that time. And so, yeah, the consequences weren't really there, so they're trying to bring attention to that. But yeah, I just felt like, you know, everything else was good, like the character design, and even I even like the character that came in later, who's kind of the antagonist. Her name is Five, and so I thought she was pretty crazy in a sense as well. But I kind of looped her in with the other characters. Like, I didn't feel that they were written really well, or we didn't get a lot of good backstory on them for me to justify the fact that they were, you know, villains. Like, I wasn't really rooting for them, and I feel like I just wanted to know what happened next. But yeah, I feel like that for me is an example of a story where I can't label them, or they are labeled as the villains in the story, mm-hmm. but it's not something that I would say that I was totally into, in a sense.
Well, you just didn't see the villainy is really what it
yeah,
is.
Yeah, I just didn't see it. Like, there's still, I don't know, it just feels like they're like kids trying to like act out, in a sense, mm-hmm. with no consequences.
I'm actually really curious now, because I only watched part of Terror of Resonance, so I totally understood what you meant by like really poor villain protagonist, but because it did win like Anime of the Year in the very early days of anime trending, what exactly made people choose it as Anime of the Year? If the protagonists themselves are so poorly written, what compelled people to even vote for it?
I don't know. I feel
is
like
it
was
just really suspense.
Yeah, like the suspense and everything else, like the character design and the music was a hot thing as well, okay. and the animation. Okay, okay. It's by MAPPA, and so that's another reason why.
It's one of MAPPA's early works. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and
The Fall. I see.
Yeah, it's in the same line as like Yuri on Ice with MAPPA. Yeah, it was MAPPA's glory days before mm-hmm. The Fall.
mm-hmm. And I think the huge draw point is also the fact that it was an original, so there's no source material to base off of. So, you know, everyone was in the same boat while watching it.
So it's just copium at that point. Wow, so sad.
Yeah, I don't know. Gracie, you watched it as well. Like, what did you think overall, or how did you see them as villains?
Mm-hmm. I definitely didn't see them as villains, but you're right, because it's like the story is telling us that they are, but you're like, no, you're not. Like, that sort of feeling. I see exactly what you're saying. I think I mean, obviously, I also really enjoyed the show, and I think it did deserve like the wins that it did win. It's definitely a critique that I would have leveled on the show. I didn't really think about it until Isabel pointed it out, but now I can't unsee it. But it doesn't ultimately take away sort of the plot and how everything's happened. So yeah. Mm-hmm. Alrighty. So I guess then, if that's your bad example, and it sounds like you're not as like naturally into this trope as Agnes and I are, so I'm really curious to hear what you picked as your good example in this case.
Yeah, I think the good examples are just ones that we already know. But I don't know, which one do you guys want? It was between Light from Death Note or Eren from Attack on Titan.
Either of those is fine. I think if you want to talk more about one than the other, I think it's great to talk about either way. Because I do agree, like, they are by their own rights, even though I don't necessarily like Eren. He is genuinely a good villain protagonist for the series of Attack on Titan, at least like towards the end, right?
Yeah, I think that's the one. I'll talk about Eren just because that was more recent, I feel like.
Okay.
And I like Eren, so that's why it's hard.
Like, that's fair.
I'm like one of those people.
Isabel
like,
hears Agnes insulting her baby every other week.
I'm sorry. You should have said something, girl.
No. I want to hear more, because I obviously need to like tone down how much I like him as a character or something like that.
Okay.
But yeah, I was like one of those people like towards the very end, like even though he caused a rumbling and everything, I was like, he's still good. Like, I still believe in him type of thing.
Oh dear.
Yeah,
well,
it's
as long
really
as
bad.
You don't become like a right-wing ultra extremist, then I'm okay with that. I accept that, because I've seen some people be like that with Eren profiles and people who really like Eren's, and I'm just like, okay, be very careful, my dude.
Oh my gosh, yeah. When we were watching Attack on Titan, actually, like towards the end, the you know last few arcs, we were watching in a group with my friends, and we're like half of us had like our profile pictures changed to Eren as like Jaegerus, and the other half had like a giant like no like over the profile.
No.
So yeah, we were like battling out in a sense, like, you know, who's on whose side. So
that's cute. That's actually really cute.
Yeah, I thought that was really fun, because that could only happen while the show was airing and stuff like that, or people who hadn't read the manga like basically, you know, was watching it. And so mm-hmm. But yeah, we had really a lot of fun with that. But yeah, Eren's hard, because like up until, you know, the last part, like you really see him as a protagonist of the show, Even though he might be like really annoying at the beginning, and I think I talked about that before, where I did not like Eren in the beginning. Like, it almost made me not want to watch Attack on Titan.
That was my gripe too. Was like Eren was mm-hmm. insufferable for the first few seasons.
did your opinion change about him at any point? Like later on when he became like less annoying, was it annoying until the end?
I just had no interest at all at that point. And okay. I was already disillusioned by the fact that so many people were swayed to be like Eren Jaegerist, but they also were like a more like right-wing conservative too. You see a lot of that on Twitter as well, mm-hmm. Who comment and being like ultra like Eren fanatics that you're just very turned off and don't want to pick up the series after that. I did watch like the first like 3-4 episodes of like the newest season, like at the very beginning, and I was like, okay, I can get on board with this. But then after everything sort of derailed and there was a lot of drama about like people attacking with studios and things like that, I was like, okay, I've had enough of this show. So I didn't actually catch up as fully as I did, but I still have very strong reservations against Eren Jaeger just because I've seen his actions in the past 3 seasons.
Okay, I can see that as well. Yeah, I think in the end, like based on things that he did, like I cannot defend all his actions, right, for the fact that he killed so many people, mm-hmm. and kind of let that happen. But I mean, in a sense, people would argue like, you know, he was stuck, like either he did this or that. But yeah, if you do bad things, you have to be labeled as a villain. But yeah, it's just that progression of him as like the protagonist, and then towards the end, obviously, being not so great. And even I think the biggest factor was the fact that like even his closest friends were like struggling, right, with Armin,
right,
and Mikasa, yeah. Like still trying to defend him, like still trying to save him, when everyone else probably would be like, nah, just like shoot him dead, like he doesn't deserve to live at this point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so it became like his friends versus like the world in a sense. And I always like that kind of like concept. Like, would you defend your friend for the world, or would you, you know, side with the world?
It's in the same lines as like, would you kill for the person you love, or like mm-hmm. let them die, right? Yeah, I see that. I don't know. Friends is a weird situation because it's kind of like, I feel like there is more of a separation.
There's a line, yeah.
There's a line. There's a degree of separation where you can tell when they really fucked up and when they didn't. So I think for me, if I had someone like Eren, my first instinct is just to leave them. I mm-hmm. would be like, whatever fate is in your hands, like if you die or if you live, that is the choice that you have, but know that you have karma that's always going to chase you. So that would have been my first instinct. So I would not be as honorable as Armin or Mikasa trying to defend for their friend to the death. But that's a very good point about how Eren is true, like a very modern and a very recent villain protagonist that is very much in the living memory of many anime fans right now.
This is more of a general comment from me, but Light throughout the year, and throughout the later years, especially as we grow up, have kind of been made into a laughing stock. We're like, oh, we used to think he was cool, but now it's like he's kind of pathetic. And I think the reaction to him is kind of similar to how some people look at Eren as well. So I was sort of curious on how do you feel about that, since those are both of your examples for good villain protagonists. Like, do you think they've mistaken the characters, or, you know, or do you think maybe they were just embarrassed about their past edgy self, so they kind of want to go the opposite? Like, yeah.
I definitely have a theory for that, is like, as you grow older, you realize that you don't have to end everything in violence, and that there's always a better side of things, and that you can always come to a resolution for certain things. Mm. Yes, it is true that you can eliminate evil from this world by killing them, like literally just cutting them as the root of the cause. But at the same time, you also have blood on your hands too. So it becomes kind of like a question of morality. Like, are you willing to accept that? Are you willing to be edgy? Are you willing to be like a stain on the world because you do the things that you do? And then kind of like having to reconcile with that. Which is why, like, for Light, Yagami is really interesting, because he's become more of a meme, because in recent memory now, many of the people that have watched Death Note are all adults. They look at that, they've been through, all of these adults have their own life experiences, and think to themselves, like, Yeah, I could kill somebody, but really, that's like, you don't want that burden on yourself either. Let's be real, we're all cowards. I am a coward. I could not kill. If I was in a fit of rage, I might be able to. If they hurt like the person I love or like my family. But the reality is, like, I don't have that much energy to figure out how to kill a certain somebody if I can just like figure out a way to like ignore them at work, right? Like, to what extent do you need to do something like that, especially for someone like Light, who lives in a very modernized Japanese society, right? For Eren, I can see why people would root for Eren more than for Light, simply because Eren is actually stuck in a war situation, and it's actually very difficult for him to come to the idea of like, is peace even an option, right? In the minds of people who live in war, sometimes peace is not an option. You have to use violence to kill people. But for somebody like Light, who lives like in a modern society, you're kind of like, really, dude? You could do better things, but okay, sure, whatever. And I think one other thing that I wanted to point out is that a lot of anime fans from between like the 90s and the 2000s have all grown into adults. And I've noticed that there has been a progression of people our age and of the previous generation who are into works like Vinland Saga, for example, mm-hmm. or let's say like Berserk or something like Vagabond, where you have characters who are very edgy. They start off very edgy. They want to kill the world. They want to kill everybody in it just because they can. And they become kind of like a villain antagonist of their own. But throughout the series, the older audience starts to connect with these characters' progression and realizing like there is a better world out there that doesn't need violence. And so they just kind of naturally move on with these types of stories and into their adulthood, as opposed to being so obsessed with something like Death Note that is now remarkably old. It's almost 20 years old at this point. And then also kind of separating themselves from Attack on Titan too.
Yeah, I feel weird about it because I really don't understand the memes of Death Note, just because for me, I thought it was a good series, and then I feel like I've held that throughout the years. Although I do think like the live action and other adaptations.
Oh, we don't talk about the Netflix live action. Yeah. That doesn't exist.
That I will black out of my memory. So like, I'll just say like the anime I thought was good at the time. Like I still, the emotions that I had like watching it as a child was different, I guess. And to be honest, I really haven't gone back to it. But in my mind, the plot of it, I thought the concept of it was just so interesting and different. And I don't think I've seen anything like nearly as, I guess, close to Death Note in a sense, because it's just so like, if you tell someone about this series, it's so easy to pinpoint it as well. Like if you were in that situation, like starting from the first episode, right? Like his just sitting there and then like a book dropping out of the sky, and then all of a sudden he's like involved in a little bit of the supernatural in a sense, and then him trying to, you know, with his ideals, and then but then also in a sense he still cares about his family a little bit. So it's like, for me, it was like half and half, and so that's why I thought he was a good character. So for me, it's hard to see why people change their opinions about it, but I can see like you said, Agnes, like people grow older, it's like, oh yeah, I think it's definitely hard for us to like relate to him now than it was in the past. So I wonder what it would be like if like we show this to like high school kids, or what their opinion of it is, or do they just think it's too old now?
No, I don't think kids would think it's too old now, but I think a lot of kids being influenced by internet things and understanding psychology a bit more too, and understanding how complex our world is at a very young age, I feel like they're a little less likely to want to be as edgy as Light. Mm-hmm. I have not heard of another case of some kid coming into a school with a Death Note as of lately. So
I think
it's a record for America.
What right I will now. Say though is I think with how split girls and queer people versus straight cis guys have become in school, and that's an actual thing. I don't know if you guys have read news articles about it, but
so sad.
Yeah, I think what's gonna happen is we're gonna have two extremes where it's like the guys worship like Light, and because Death Note, as you said, is quite old now, like I don't think the kids are really watching it anymore, but I do think the guys would worship Light, and then the girls and the queers would probably hate him and be on the other end of the spectrum and not like have like more of an in-between sort of stance. So that's my guess, at least.
That's going to be so sad because it's basically like splitting the nerd culture and group so far out.
Right,
that
yeah.
hates groups, and that just sucks. Yeah. That just sucks in my perspective because now you can't bond with people over the same shows you watch.
Mm-hmm.
You have to bond with people within your same group for your gender.
I know, I know. I mean, obviously it's not so like black and white as that, but it has
echo chamber.
Yes, but it has been more and more like grouped off that way. So yeah.
Ew, disgusting.
Alrighty, well, thank you so much for sharing that, Isabel. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I hope you guys enjoyed our trope dissection. We haven't done one in a while, but it was good to be back. And we will be back with another fun topic next week, so I hope you'll still be here next time. So, bye, everyone.
Bye-bye. Bye.